grounded by contact with the chair or the ground in this present moment of awareness. And we will chant the prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru, four continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. So I realized I should have let Lama Jinzong lead the prayers. That's why. Rather than do the teacher prayers, I'll leave those. Do you have your teacher prayers with you, Lama Jinzong? We can do those after the meditation when you start teaching. Is that good? Okay, great. All right. Well prepared as always. So I'm, wait a minute. Yes, Lama Jinzong.
I schlepped all my books down in my suitcases. So, I mean, I'm like everything, but it was worth it because I wanted to be here and yes, part of your group.
Yes. Well, our group, our okay, everybody's group. Okay. All right. All right. We'll do the meditation and then you can do your teacher prayers and launch. So we're going to do a concise meditation today to leave plenty of room for our topic. But we'll start out in the usual way, bringing our mind to rest. We already did that, so hopefully we're still in that state of restful focus. And if not, let's just tune into it again. You could follow a few breaths if it helps, or just open your awareness. And contemplating the four reminders in the words translated of the ninth Karmapa, the precious human existence. First, I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources, difficult to attain, easily destroyed. From now on, I must make this life meaningful. That was our topic from last week, so it should be very fresh in our minds, the meaning of each of those observations. Secondly, everything is impermanent, the world and all it contains. In particular, the life of beings is as fragile as a bubble of water. The time of death is uncertain, and when I die, I will be nothing but a corpse. At that time, only the Dharma can help me. I must practice diligently. Thirdly, when death comes, I will not be free. My fate will depend upon my previous actions. I must, therefore, refrain from negative actions, always engage in positive actions, and each day attend to my stream of being. And fourthly, all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else in the cycle of existence continually torment me through the three types of suffering. They are like the last meal before my execution. I must sever all attachment and diligently accomplish awakening. So So now, having definitively resolved to free ourselves from samsara in order to help all other beings become free for the reasons just stated, we will request the blessing of the Lama, and you can request the blessing of the Buddha or a deity if that's more comfortable. With or without words, just visualizing the Lama or the Buddha in a body of light on a lotus and moon seat above the crown of our head, radiating light, radiating love, compassion, bodhicitta, and awakening, all the qualities that we wish to cultivate. Requesting a Lama's blessing, but just with heartfelt devotion, that constant sense, as Kala Rinpoche said, of inspiration, motivation, connection, presence, and clarity that we feel in the presence of the Lama, of the Buddha. Through our devotion, we receive the blessing of the Lama or the Buddha, and they descend to our crown, into our heart center, and remain there. So coming back, if we've left it, if we've become distracted, coming back to our focused, relaxed state of resting in the present moment, we're going to do the abbreviated cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta today from Pema Chodron, which is flash openness. Just touch in instantaneously with that sense of open, limitless awareness that is part of the nature of our mind. Just letting ourselves relax more and more into openness, non-judgmentalness, not trying to create any particular state of meditation, but just resting as it is. Touching in with our Buddha nature, with the nature of mind, with the way things really are. We can just go directly there anytime. And within this state of resting in the essence, resting in awareness, resting in clarity, we cultivate relative bodhicitta by this, through the slogan, practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. So today we'll do the classic sequence from the 7 points of mind training from the Great Path of Awakening. First, bringing to mind a person or people, a pet, anyone towards whom we naturally feel love and compassion. A parent, a pet, someone who's been kind to us, a teacher. And we think of the fact that they experience suffering, and we fervently wish for them not to have suffering because they've been so kind to us in this lifetime, or because we just have such natural love and compassion for them. We don't want them to suffer, and we just let ourselves feel that emotion. That wishing, it could feel a little sad, that wishing for them not to suffer. And having generated this strong feeling of compassion, then we engage in the activity that through our practice, we feel that it can relieve them of their suffering, which is to breathe in whatever suffering they may have, and you can use the visualization if it's helpful of the dark, heavy smoke the suffering takes. breathing it into our nostrils and through all the pores of our body without flinching, without holding back, just breathing it all in and letting it dissolve along with our breath. Breathing out to them whatever they need, healing, happiness, peace, awakening. We do a few rounds for that person or people, and if more people come to mind, then include them as well. People that you feel compassion for already. Very relaxed, but not losing track of the motivation and the visualization if we have one. And now bring to mind also, just extend this feeling of compassion. We're going to extend it step by step to all sentient beings, beginning next with someone that we see or we're aware of, but we don't really have a feeling for. They're just a neutral person to us. Someone we were just on the airplane with, or someone we pass on the street, a neighbor we don't know really, a delivery person. And we breathe in their suffering, whatever it may be. Let it dissolve in the same way. We're not holding on to it either. Breathing out the antidote to their suffering, breathing out healing, happiness, peace. And thirdly, and you can skip this step if it only brings negativity to mind, but if it's possible to do it even a little, if you can bring to mind someone that you're angry with, someone who's been giving you a hard time, or someone you feel has treated you unfairly, or someone who's just an out-and-out enemy, or someone you consider a bad person, if we could include them and breathe in without thinking too much about it, just whatever suffering they may have, because they have suffering too. And sometimes people's negativity comes out of their own suffering. Just breathing in that suffering and breathing in whatever negativity they have. Let it dissolve and breathe out whatever they need wholeheartedly. And again, you can skip this step and stick with those you love if necessary. And now, extending our intention and our visualization to include all sentient beings of all six realms as psychological realms that anyone could be experiencing, or as real realms that we could be born into somewhere. Breathing in all the suffering of the hell realms, the hungry ghosts, the animal realm, all humans, even the gods and the jealous gods, breathing it all in. Letting it dissolve and breathing out peace, happiness, healing, wakefulness, acceptance. Touching back in, even as we're doing this, touching back in if we've lost it a bit with our Buddha nature, with that sense of just open, relaxed awareness, even as we do our taking and sending. Sending that open, relaxed awareness to all beings as well. And thinking finally that through our practice, we and all sentient beings are completely free of suffering, completely filled with happiness, completely awake,
And we should rejoice in that for a moment. And then let go of all our visualization and conceptuality, coming back to just resting in awareness, resting in the essence. And now coming back to our study mode, slowly stretching a little, taking a sip of water if you need to. And I will turn over the meeting to Lama Jinzong.
So, hello, can you hear me? Okay. So I'll begin with the four dharmas of Gompopa. Dakta Sam Chantan, Cheji, Loju Su Jor Sinji Lapdu So, Chu Lam Du Jor Sinji Lapdu So, Lam Ju Or Zewar Sinji Lapdu So, Jupa Yeshe Su Jor Sinji Lapdu So, I pray for a blessing. May my mind and the mind of all sentient beings turn towards the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And then from the aspiration of excellent conduct. Lai ke dan lu dan u ji ke ju pu ta ta mi I ke na dan jo wa kun ji dra ke ji san par tam che ke du da ke ju ten do. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now, as a preliminary, we should now turn our minds and engender the altruistic attitude of bodhicitta. So to do that, in the beginning, please give rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So, I'll be using primarily, again, the path to Buddhahood, and this version of Ornament of Precious Liberation, but I will be also bringing in the sixth verse of 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. I'll be referring to this, the text by His Holiness Karmapa, Traveling the Path of Compassion, because verse 6 is his description, it is the description of the topic for today's teaching, which is the spiritual friend. And then as I go on, I'll be pulling some information, some content from some texts that I've been reading that refer to the concept of lineage, devotion, the guru, because all of those are, those topics are brought up, but they're just passed over. They're sort of an assumed knowledge of everything. So I'll be explaining, you know, I'll be fleshing that out. So I think all of you have been coming to the class, but again, this text is the jewel ornament of liberation, or is the ornament of precious liberation, is the instructions that Gompopa outlines of for why it is that we are able to attain enlightenment. And the first two that we've already covered is the fact that all of us, without exception, have the potential already within us, the Buddha nature, and that all we have to do is reveal it through the methods, that it's already perfectly innate and complete within us, and it's equally in all beings, so there is no reason that we could not attain Buddhahood, because in fact it is just the revealing and the full ripening of the Buddha nature. The second factor is the basis, which Lama Chödrön went over, which is the precious human existence. That is not just being born human, where you have both the ability to experience suffering, but the leisure, or as it were, the ability to experience pleasure or temporary happiness. So you're not continuously suffering, but it's not just an ordinary human body. It also assumes that you, or is defined as having many conditions met, such that you've met the Dharma, that you have the mental capacity to understand the Dharma. And so for all of these reasons, it's considered a very precious and rare opportunity, and we should try our best not to waste it. The third factor of the six factors is where we begin today, the condition. And so I'm beginning on page 15 of Rinko Tuku's book, and he refers to the condition. He translates it as, oh no, he doesn't. I'm wrong. That's because I'm on the wrong page. Okay, he does say the condition. And so that would be, I'm sorry, page 23. So I will begin. The third factor, the condition to reach enlightenment, is meeting a genuine spiritual friend. This is a person who has the ability and willingness to guide us in the right direction, and in whom we have the trust and confidence to follow. What chains us to samsara is our deep-rooted habit of always following either the wrong direction or erroneous schemes. To help us, protect us, and encourage us to completely abandon this habit and to guide us in the right direction, we need someone strong, a friend whom we can rely upon. Without serious help, a drug addict or an alcoholic is not likely to overcome his or her addiction. In the same way, without an experienced guide whom we can totally trust, we will have a lot of difficulties getting out of the samsaric patterns to which we are deeply accustomed. This chapter is divided into five parts. The first outlines the reasons it's necessary to have a spiritual friend. The second lists the four categories of spiritual friends. The third describes the essential characteristics of the different types of spiritual friends. The fourth gives advice about how to enter into a relationship with a spiritual friend and specifies what questions to ask. The fifth describes the benefits that a spiritual friend brings. So the first then in this list of parts, as it says, of divided into five parts, is the explanation as or discussion as to why we need a spiritual friend. So Gampopa justifies the need for a spiritual friend by making three points. So the first is the authority of the Buddha's own words, which he quotes many times. So as we've learned previously, in the different types of reasoning in Buddhist philosophy, the first is scriptural, which is basically to say the Buddha or the great masters themselves have said this, and so that's a reason. The second type had been pointed out previously is like logical reasoning, and finally another form of reasoning is what's known as empirical reasoning. So this first, which is the spiritual authority, so again it says the first is the authority of the Buddha's own words, which he quotes many times. Good disciples devoted to their teachers should always be guided by wise and skillful mentors. Why? Because that is how their own qualities of skill and wisdom will emerge. And again, thus the great bodhisattva who wishes to awaken genuinely and totally to peerless, utterly pure, and perfect enlightenment should from the very outset seek out, relate to, and serve good mentors. The Buddha has often repeated that the starting point of the right path is the meeting with a good spiritual friend. Indeed, one of the three jewels is the Sangha, of which spiritual friends are an integral part. They are the ones who help us, encourage us, and are the example to follow. To take refuge in the Sangha actually means that we find a good example to look up to, and then we try to create an environment in which we are likely to be influenced by this model. However, if one doesn't have too much trust in the Buddha's words, another argument is given. So now we get into the argument based on logic. So he continues, this second point is logically based. If we sincerely desire to stop suffering, live correctly, and realize enlightenment, there is no way to reach these goals without the help of an adequate spiritual guide. To find the right path, we must first find someone who has already treaded it. Without an appropriate guide, how can we find the path to enlightenment? Well, I personally found that confusing. It didn't strike me, again, it didn't seem like it was, the way it was pointed out there wasn't as clear to me, because again, it was just sort of providing some kind of conclusion already. So I'm now turning, it seemed easier for me to understand page 38 in the Ornament of Precious Liberation. Top of 38, it says, for the logical justification, the reasoning is, and so here's where they actually define for you what the form of reasoning is. It says that given that you wish to attain omniscience, so this is what's considered the subject. The subject is attaining its omniscience. It says you need to rely on Dharma masters. Predicate, and when I learned, looked that up, that means it's some kind of verb asserting something about the subject. So the subject is omniscience, and you're asserting something. You're saying, I need to rely on, or you need to rely on Dharma masters. And so the logic comes in when they now provide the reason, which is saying, because by yourself, you do not know how to accrue spiritual wealth or how to dispel your obscurations. The Buddhas of the three times are an example substantiating this assertion. The Pratyeka Buddhas are an example of the contrary. The above is explained as follows. For us to achieve perfect Buddhahood, all forms of spiritual wealth will need to be accrued, and that accrual depends on Dharma masters. Furthermore, we need to rid ourselves of all the obscurations summarized in terms of, so the first one is the afflictions obscuration or the mental afflictions. And the second is the obscurations to knowledge. Their removal is also dependent on Dharma masters. So the logical justification here is that the reason you need to rely on masters in order to attain realization is because we simply don't know how to do it ourselves. And now I'm going to continue in this text for the third argument, which is the justification by analogy. So this is that a Dharma master is like a guide when traveling an unknown path, like an escort when in a dangerous land, and like a ferryman when crossing a mighty river. The first example is that of a guide. Traveling in unfamiliar lands without a guide, you risk going in the wrong direction or making a longer or shorter detour. But if there is a companion guide, there are none of these risks, and the destination can be attained without a single wasted step. Like this, if there is no good Mahayana Dharma teacher when setting out on the path to peerless enlightenment and heading for that state, then there is the danger of mistakenly taking an aberrant path, or even without straying that gravely, of making the greater detour of what are known as the hearers, the Shravaka, or the lesser detour of the Pratyeka Buddhas, and those are those who are self-realized, not depending on a teacher in that particular lifetime. When accompanied by good Dharma teachers who are like guides, there is no longer this danger of taking a completely wrong path or of a large or small detour, and the citadel or the level of omniscience will be reached. So this is especially important in our days because so much is translated now into English, and we have access to so much now that we have so many opportunities to develop doubt or wrong understanding. Like for instance, when I was in my first retreat and we were studying a practice POA of the transference of consciousness, and it said I was reading one English translated text. I forget the name. I shouldn't say anyway. I don't want to, you know. But anyway, fortunately for you all, I or for me, I forget the name of the writer, but of the translator. But anyway, it was a book in English translating this topic. And it said that if you don't have a perfectly, if your body is an imperfect shape, like a perfect spine, you won't be able to do this practice. And I have had now two back operations, but at the time I had one. So I have a rebuilt chassis. I do not have my original spine. I don't have any metal, but in any case, it's rebuilt. And so I went to Lamanor Lorimpiche in my first retreat and I said, oh my God, this means that I won't be able to, you know, perfect this practice. And he was so wrathful with me. He said, you should, that's not true. It's meditation. You know, this is not a flesh and blood body. We're dealing with meditative states and what you can do with your mind. And he was like, never read another English book, you know, about anything. And it stuck with me for a long time. I mean, I'm really careful about not looking at translations because as we see, as Lama Chodron's pointed out, that oftentimes the text in Tibetan is always the same, the root text, but the translations differ dependent on the karma of the translator. So that was a very good example of, for me, really hit home that without a spiritual guide to really point out what is right and what is wrong and what to worry about and what not to worry about, you know, what to have fear about, what to have and not have fear about. I mean, that was very meaningful for me at that time. So I'm going to pick up again, although I'm going to skip over the quote, you know, the scriptural quote, and we'll go down. Just the second example is that of the escort. So this is the second of three justifications by analogy. So the second one is that of the escort. In dreaded places, there are harmful things such as bandits, thieves, wild animals, and the like. Going to such places without an escort is dangerous for possessions, for physical safety, and even for life. When accompanied by a powerful escort, however, we pass through without mishap. Similarly, without a Dharma master to act as an escort on the path to enlightenment, accruing spiritual wealth and heading for the citadel of omniscience, we risk having our wealth of virtue plundered by that band of thieves that consists of ideas and mental afflictions within and harmful forces and misleading influences without. There is even the risk of our life in the happier realms being cut short. Therefore, it is said, as soon as that gang of robbers and thieves, meaning the mental afflictions, find the opportunity, they will steal virtue and put an end to the life in the higher states. So again, this is like in the dedication prayer we have at the end where it says, this merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, which, so we're pointing out that the enemy is in fact our own faults, our own internal misguided misperception, our confused way of working with whatever arises in our minds. So again, the escort, the example, is that the spiritual friends can, again, help you, can protect you, can train you so that you have a more skillful means of working with your emotional afflictions, your own thoughts, and keep you correctly on the path, learning how to transform and in fact taking what is negative in your life, whether it be your own thoughts or external conditions, and being able to transform those negative conditions as means to enhance your own practice. So it continues, it says, never straying from the Dharma master who is like an escort, the wealth of virtue will not be lost. Existence as a being in the higher realms will not be cut short, and the citadel of omniscience will be obtained. And finally, skip down to where it says the third example. It says the third example is that of a ferryman. Crossing a mighty river, you may be securely aboard the boat, but if there is no ferryman, you cannot reach the other shore, and the boat may sink or be swept away by the currents. With a ferryman, and through his striving, however, or his or her striving, however, the other shore will be reached. Likewise, when trying to traverse the ocean of samsara without Dharma masters who are like ferrymen, you may well be aboard the ship of Dharma, yet drown in samsara or be carried off by its currents. Thus it is said, when there is no oarsman, the vessel will not reach the other side. Even if one may be accomplished in all, yet without a master, existence will be endless. Staying on board with the ferryman like Dharma master, Nirvana, the dry land of the far shore of samsara, will be attained. Therefore it says in the marvelous Array Sutra, delivering us from the ocean of samsara, the Dharma master is like a ferryman. Thus one really needs to rely on Dharma masters who are like guides, escorts, and ferrymen. And now I'm returning to Ringo Tuku. Text, page 25. It's just this, the first full paragraph where it says, a spiritual path is not just an intellectual pursuit. It is about transforming our way of experiencing and reacting to the world. We need to learn how to do that the way a musician learns how to play an instrument. We need an experienced teacher who can show us how to do that and who can help in our learning process. And now I just want to introduce one. This is from Tim Olstead giving a talk once, and this is just, it seemed to give a nice relatable way, again, of why we need to, again, depend or ask for help or look towards help on the path. And he says, we can ask ourselves, how do we know what is possible and how to proceed along the path, other than through the guidance and example of those who have gone before? This is simply what we call lineage. Can we make up our own stories? Can we pull this path out of our head? We can no more do that than conjure up a map to drive us to New York City if we haven't already been there before. It is a nature of confusion that we cannot make up a path by ourselves that wakes us up. We need to be open to something else, to someone else. As an example, we cannot navigate the way through confusion by ourselves. You could say, we do not know what we do not know. It is as if we wanted to become a tennis player. Oh, so he's saying this is what you would do. If we wanted to become a tennis player, and in doing so, we hung out with other tennis players, we open ourselves to their guidance, we lean into them, we follow their example, and we gain encouragement and strength from them. The lineage is very much a training paradigm. You could say that we lean into and we open up to the pros that went before. So now that completes the first of the five parts in the chapter, which is the reason to have a spiritual friend. And now the second aspect point in this chapter is what types of categories, what types of spiritual friends there are. So I'm continuing back in page 25 in Ringo Tōkō, where it says, the different categories of spiritual friends. Gampopa distinguishes four categories of spiritual friends. The first groups together spiritual friends who are ordinary human beings. The second, the bodhisattvas who have reached a high degree of spiritual development. The third, the emanations of the Buddhas in the Nirmanakaya form. And the fourth, emanations of the Buddhas in the Sambhogakaya form. So we're going to go to page 40 in the Ornament of Precious Liberation to expand upon this a little bit. And I mean now about the second full paragraph where it says these correspond. So again, he's talking again, we've just listed the four different types or kinds of Dharma master. And Gampopa says, these correspond to the personal situation. Since one is totally unable to rely on Buddhas or Bodhisattvas while still a beginner in the Dharma, a Dharma master in the form of a specific individual is relied upon. When most of the action-related obscurations have been purified, one is able to rely on a Dharma master who is a Bodhisattva on the levels. So when it says when most of the action-related obscurations have been purified, it means that you have a certain amount of karma and confusion has been, the veils have been lifted such that you can actually begin to experience different kind of appearances that arise in the mind. So right now, we are unable to see anything but what we are able to see because we are limited. We've actually limited what it is we're able to perceive, based so much on the fact that we just assume that everything around us is solid. And we are limited, therefore, to what we think we can see. And we don't have the ability to see the level that is being referred to by these bodhisattvas. Because it says here, when most of the action-related obscurations have been purified, one is able to rely on a Dharma master who is a bodhisattva on the levels. From the topmost stage of the path of accumulation onward, one can rely on a Dharma master in the Nirmanakaya form of a Buddha. Once the Bodhisattva levels are attained, it is possible to rely on a Dharma master in the Sambhogakaya form of a Buddha. Which of these four types is kindest to us? At the outset, when still in the dark pit of action and affliction, were we to try to rely on Dharma masters of the three latter types, we would not even be capable of seeing their faces. We wouldn't even be able to perceive of them. We're so clouded by our afflictions. It is only due to our path being illuminated by the lamp held aloft by teachers who are specific individuals that we will eventually encounter them. Therefore, masters in the form of specific individuals are the kindest. So now I'm going to go back and pick up where we left off in Ringu Toku, again, page 25. And it says, so he's reiterates the again, this point of the first level student. It says, although the great bodhisattvas are ideal teachers, it's not easy for ordinary people like us to recognize a member of the latter three categories, much less make contact with one of them. The category of masters to whom ordinary people like us can have access is the first one, the masters who are not totally awakened, but who are well on the way. They are more or less like us, but already have a certain training, a certain level of serious spiritual practice. This type of spiritual friend is appropriate for the student of the first level. The third category groups together the Buddha's emanations. According to the scriptures of Mahayana Buddhism, Buddha Shakyamuni himself is considered a Buddha emanation. He is what we call a perfect form of Nirmanakaya. We can distinguish different forms of Nirmanakaya or different Buddha's emanation. Three types of Nirmanakaya are usually mentioned. The supreme Nirmanakaya, like Buddha Shakyamuni, manifestations by birth in human or animal form, and the creative manifestations, animate or inanimate, such as a bridge, a boat, or medicine. This is possible because a Buddha can appear in any form that is useful and can benefit sentient beings whenever and wherever this aid is necessary. The last category groups the real Buddhas who have realized perfect enlightenment. Since the three types of masters are out of our reach or out of reach for us, we will concentrate on the first one, the level of ordinary friends. So I am going to do as Ringo Tuchel does. I'm going to skip over what you, if you're interested, you can see in the book of Gompopa, Ornaments of Precious Liberation, page 40, where it talks in detail about the category or the qualities or the characteristics of these higher bodhisattvas on the levels, etc. So it's on page 40 and 41, but I'm actually going to skip over that and follow, but that's where you would find if you're interested in specific details. But I'm going to continue with Rinko Toko now, because as he said, since the last three types of masters are out of reach for us, we'll concentrate on the first one, the level of ordinary spiritual friends. So it says, the qualities of ordinary spiritual friends. So again, I'm on page 26 of Rinko Toko. The qualities of ordinary spiritual friends. It is very important to choose a worthy spiritual friend. This is why the qualities of a genuine teacher are clearly described. The texts usually mention 8, 4, or 2 qualities that are considered essential. According to a sutra called the Bodhisattva's Levels, teachers or spiritual guides should have 8 particular qualities. 1, they must first of all follow the precepts and vows of a bodhisattva. And again, the bodhisattva vow is that I am acting not only to attain freedom from suffering for myself, but to be able to lead, guide all beings without exception, without any partiality, to the level of complete enlightenment. 2, they must have studied in depth the teachings of the path of the bodhisattva. 3, their understanding must be deep and not purely intellectual. They must have truly experienced the teachings. 4, they must feel sincere compassion toward all sentient beings. 5, they must be fearless and show a lot of courage, not only in their own actions, but also when they teach others. 6, they must be tolerant and patient with their students and their practice. 7, they must be tenacious and not allow themselves to be carried away by discouragement or disappointment. 8, finally, they must be capable of communicating effectively with students. So there's an example that follows showing why it's important that you need to be able to communicate, because a teacher was for 2 years teaching in to a huge number of monks, but in a language that they didn't know. So even though he spent 2 years teaching them, they were unable to gain any wisdom because they did not understand anything of his teachings. So as it says, the last sentence on the paragraph on 27, he was an excellent teacher, but because he could not communicate with his students, he couldn't help them.
I'm realizing that must be the meaning of the second prayer we chant as teachers.
Correct.
The Dharma in all the languages.
That's right. Yeah. And we're lucky at least now. I mean, it is an issue for us having the obstacle of, you know, language barrier, and we're lucky that we have translators, and as the teachers are coming to the West, they have been and are continuing to have to learn the languages of other countries in order to communicate directly, so that you have a sense of transmission directly from the teacher. So then continuing on page 27, it says, in certain other texts, the Mahayana Sutralankara, for example, 4 qualities are described. First of all, the teacher must be very learned and have vast knowledge. Next, he must have a deep analytical wisdom, which helps him conquer his students' doubts. His conduct must be perfectly virtuous and honest, so that he truly deserves the respect and confidence of everyone. Finally, he must be able to point out problems, disturbing emotions, negative aspects of life, and the means to avoid them. The teacher who has all these qualities is an authentic spiritual friend. So in this particular case, I feel as if this might be talking perhaps in the Galupa sect. We are Kajupa, at least Tipton Trolling are Kajupa in lineage. And so when it says that they must be have a deep analytical wisdom, that's not necessarily true. That seems like in the Galupa, where they have a strong tradition of study and 13 years of intellectual training. So this is, again, another version that may, for beings who are very inclined towards scholasticism, that might be what appeals to them. So that's a different understanding. And also where it says his conduct must be perfectly virtuous and honest, I will be speaking to that very soon, basing comments on what His Holiness the Karmapa taught recently, because this is a perfect example of how the spiritual friends is often related to in books as being the most ideal, and how difficult that is to match that ideal, and how problematic that is when looking at a teacher for the qualities of teaching, and what does that mean to seeing faults when they're supposed to be absolutely perfect, such that only if his conduct is perfectly virtuous and honest that he can truly deserve respect and confidence. So I'll be speaking to that as we go forward. So because that, you know, that stood out to me, that was problematic for me. And finally, it says in the Bodhicharya Vatara, Shantideva mentions only two qualities. First, the teacher must be well-versed in the teachings related to the practices of the bodhisattvas. Second, he must practice them himself and should be ready to give up his life rather than to abandon them. And now I'm going to leave this text and speak more. I wanted to just say that another simple way of, oh, well, no, I'll skip over that for now because I can't find it. So now what I'd like to do is I'm switching over to this text, which is The Traveling, The Path of Compassion by His Holiness the 17th Karmapa. And we recently, many of you might know that, many of you know or may know that he recently, I don't know, recently, 2 months ago, whenever it was, taught at Riverside Church in New York City on the practices of the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. And so although this text was written quite a number of years ago, in 2009, it was published. I did also take notes from what he included on this topic just recently. So I'd like to just read. So I'm actually going to read from Lama Chidren's translation, which is the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. So this would be verse 6, and it says, "When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. Constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic Dharma friends more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains." So I'm going to be reading from this text. We're on page 60 now. And it says, this verse speaks of a good friend or positive influence, which we call a spiritual friend. The literature of Buddhism discusses the many different qualities of a spiritual friend or teacher. From the Vinaya to the Vajrayana, a variety of spiritual characteristics are recommended, and it may not be easy to find someone who has them all. In fact, it is very difficult to find such a person. Nevertheless, we have to try to find someone who has fewer faults and weaknesses and more positive qualities. So this is very important. So he's saying that it's a balance. We have to look now and do the strengths overweigh the weaknesses. The last two lines of this stanza tell us how to relate to this person, which is to cherish a genuine spiritual friend more than our own body. We'll be speaking more to this next week when we go into the relationship, the student, the teacher-disciple relationship, but I'll continue today with that in the book. It says, it is important, however, that we do not make a mistake here, but relate to our spiritual friends in a correct way. When we are searching for the right guide, it is said that we should not choose too soon and that we should stay focused on our purpose, not accepting just anyone we meet who is called a teacher. It is not necessary to take someone as a spiritual friend immediately. Nevertheless, once we have decided to relate to someone as our teacher, we should not continue to look around. In brief, We should search first and be very clear about our decision, and only then relate to someone as our spiritual friend. Not choosing a spiritual friend too soon means that when we start searching, we consider whether a person has all or most of the qualities of a teacher. This is the focus of our investigation, not whether we like the person or not. If we are preoccupied with our likes and dislikes and do not examine someone's qualifications as a spiritual friend, we will not know whether we are attracted to a good person or a bad person, to someone who has the necessary qualities or not. We could like someone who does not measure up, and without knowing it, we could be relating to an unqualified person. For that person, we should not be too hasty in choosing a spiritual friend. So I found this to be very, very meaningful, because Lamanorla Rinpoche said to me, or said to us, sometime during my first retreat, and he said, "I am not your friend. I'm not your psychologist. I'm here to prepare you for the moment of death." So, as this says, it's not a question of whether we like or don't like someone, and how we then relate to a teacher with all our thoughts of, does he like me, or is she like me, or not like me? That's really a projection of our own needs and our own way of perceiving. And this idea, again, as Lamanorla Rinpoche said, it wasn't his job to be our friend, to be casual. It wasn't his job to be our psychiatrist, to try to figure things out in that way. His job was to give us the means to prepare us for our moment of death, which is, I believe, the kindest kind of offering anyone could provide or offer. Anyway, so continuing in the text, it says, once we have accepted someone as our spiritual friend, however, we search no more. We should already have done whatever tests were necessary to find out whether the qualities of this potential teacher were greater than his or her faults. And at that point, we should have made our decision. Having done this, we stop evaluating the teacher. At this point, there is no benefit in continuing to test, because now we have to relate to that person as a guide. Again, not as a friend, but as a guide. How do we do this? We do not think the Buddha said, it is good to have a spiritual friend, so I must have one. Here, it is not just our head, but our feelings that come into play. This connection with the teacher has to come from our heart in a living way, and to spring from our deepest aspiration. We relate with our whole being to discover how our practice can benefit from this relationship. What do I have to learn? What is my real interest? It is our experience that will give us the answer, not endless examination. It is a little like loving someone. We do not love a person because we have been told that we must love them. We love someone because it flows from our heart. In the same way, relating to the spiritual friend has to come from our heart and resonate with our deepest purpose in life. When this happens, we receive the benefits of an authentic relationship with a spiritual friend. Otherwise, if we keep on examining, we will create a distance between ourselves and our teacher. Now, I want to clarify right away that when it says loving someone and something that comes from our heart, we're not talking about actual love. And here's where I'd like to just pull out a statement from the recent Chöptö Kala Rinpoche's teachings at Thubten Trolling. And this comes from a text that was posted, and it is posted still on our website, kaju.com. But it says, we need a teacher or instructor to guide us along the path. And in order to fully realize the path, we need devotion. So I'm using here in this the idea of loving a teacher or feeling devoted to a teacher. He repeatedly defined devotion as not guru worship, which he discouraged, or even as specific prayers, but as a constant sense of inspiration, motivation, connection, presence, and mental clarity based on our relationship with our teacher. So when it says here, we love someone because it flows from our heart, in the same way relating to the spiritual friend has to come from our heart and resonate with our deepest purpose in life, the point here is that our deepest purpose in life, if it is to free ourselves from suffering, then we're looking not to the teacher personally, but to the teachings that the teacher is providing. And if it resonates, if the teachings of the teacher resonate in us, and then, as Chöpche Kala Rinpoche said, if we feel because of that that resonance, that there's a sense, not an intellectual sense, not coming just from, as he says, from examination, but if there is a deep sense that's coming from the heart, a sense of inspiration, of motivation, a feeling of connection and mental clarity, then that is what I believe he's referring to here. Anyway, he finishes in the book, he says, further, since every human being has a positive side and a negative side, both qualities and faults, we will certainly find some faults. There is no human being who is free of every fault. If we find some faults in our new spiritual friend, we might seek out another teacher and begin anew with another chapter. Again, we will go through the whole process of investigation and testing, and again we will find faults. So the process will just keep on repeating itself. We could spend our whole life trying to find the right spiritual friend and never receive any of the benefits this relationship has to offer. So now I just would like to add some notes that I took when he taught this this verse again just recently at Riverside Church. And so this was very, very profound to me. He said, you should rely upon spiritual friends who cause your negative qualities to decrease and good qualities to gradually increase. And therefore, cherish the spiritual friend who brings about these changes. So what's like extremely important is you don't continue to look at the spiritual friend for their faults and their strengths, but rather see how you are relating and learning and changing in relationship or due to the relationship you have with the teacher. So he also said, it's important to see that your own negative poisons can project negativity on a flawless spiritual friend and therefore cause your own poisons to increase. So again, we're always looking through our own, you know, we're always seeing through our own subjective projections. And so we have no idea if that feeling that we're projecting onto the teacher, or as I learned in this book called Having Difficult Conversations, it says one of the most important points is that you don't take the impact of someone's actions as being equal to their intent. So the idea that perhaps you see a spiritual friend acting in a certain way, you know, from my own personal experience, I've been with Lama Norla Rinpoche for 30 years. I was, you know, in the beginning, I grew up with older sisters. And so Lama Norla Rinpoche was like dad, and I would be comparing myself to older sisters. And it was like, when he said nice things to some, and then he was always very wrathful to me, you know, and I was constantly having to go through the whole ego trip of, you know, this is not that I'm bad, you know, and that they're better. And learning that the way that he communicated with people was the way that they needed to be communicated with to hear. So in other words, he said to me once, I can be very wrathful because you listen to what I say. And it cuts through my particular set of emotional afflictions. Whereas other people, he said, if they don't listen, or if the only way they can remain in the Dharma is to coddle them a bit, he'll have to coddle them a bit. But that doesn't mean from his side, he feels any closer to those that he's appearing warmer to than to me, who he seemed almost angry. But I'm projecting anger onto him. So again, I can't speak to what he is based on my reaction to him. And that's why, again, I think when His Holiness was saying it's important to see that your own negative poisons can project negativity on a flawless spiritual being and increase your own poisons to increase, because again, if I'm seeing him acting nice to some and not so nice to others, I could be judging that he likes some more than others, etc. That's increasing my negativity. My own poisons, my own mental afflictions are increasing, and it has nothing to do, in fact, with the teacher himself, because that's not where they're coming from. They're trying to benefit beings in each the way they need to, but it's not, again, based on them thinking that's a friend, or, you know, that I'm closer. All of us equally are in the teacher's mandala as students. So then the next point that His Holiness Karmapa said, he said, and we spoke a little bit about this earlier, he said, in the text, spiritual friends are described as ideal. And in reality, if a spiritual friend is not flawless, or you change for the better. Okay, so he says this is a problem, that they're described as ideal. And he said earlier, you know, human beings have flaws, and spiritual friends emanating or in the form of humans, they may be acting out in a certain way to for a certain reason, but again, they never have their own personal need, or it's never about their own ego that they're having to bolster. They're acting for the benefit of others. So if you are seeing flaws, the point is, does their influence on you change you for the better, increase your spirituality, increase your courage? That is what you're looking at. It's not whether the spiritual teacher is perfect or not. It's that, is their influence on you changing you for the better? Is it helping you to move forward on your spiritual path, increasing your courage to continue on the path? And this is the final point I'll bring up for today. And I think this is really, really, this was very profound to me, is when we talk about an authentic teacher, what does authenticity mean? And the problem, especially in today's world, is where we hear about teachers acting in one way with some students and in some ways with others, and there's questions, etc., that he said that authenticity really should be proven by the benefit it brings to each student, so that you shouldn't be thinking of the authenticity of the teacher in relation to his entire or her entire activity, but rather in interdependence with a particular disciple. So we should not talk about spiritual friends in isolation. It's, in other words, to talk about them as if they're just, they act and are one way to all beings, but rather look at them individually. And again, personally, the idea is, does this teacher benefit me? Have I benefited from this teacher? And if I have, then there is no doubt that they are an authentic teacher. The authenticity comes from your own personal experience with your personal relationship with the teacher. So I'm just going to open this up now, because it's a lot. And where we begin next is we would return to the Ringo Tolko book, which is now the master-disciple relationship. But that's very heavy duty. It brings up issues of, it brings up a lot of thoughts that I have pulled out, again, several sources to help us work forward for those. So I thought maybe it's better to stop now. And if anyone has any thoughts or questions, I will say that I might say, well, we'll be speaking to it next week and, you know, whatever, but go ahead. So how do we do this?
Do you want to call on the person and then I'll unmute them?
Okay. So John.
Okay. John, you're unmuted.
Okay. When you read the Karmapa's book.
Yeah.
I got the impression that he was saying that you need to do your research and choose one teacher.
I'm sorry, could you talk a little louder?
I'm sorry.
I was
under the impression with it that he was saying that you need to choose, do your research and choose one teacher and not have other teachers. Although I've heard other teachers saying that it's okay to have more than one, but we're saying here one.
Correct. I didn't see that in that. I think what he's saying is, because I've always been taught as well that, you know, root lama, you could have more than one root lama, that by definition, the idea of a root lama is someone who points out the nature of your own mind. What I was getting from him was that he was saying, you don't, as a matter of fact, I'm sort of seeing it as the opposite, is that he is saying, once you feel that the good of a teacher outweighs the negative of the teacher, accept that teacher and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and continually look for perfection and keep looking for perfection. But in fact, just when you have a teacher that you feel is really benefiting you, then accept them and just work with the teachings. And again, stop continuously looking at the teacher per se, but work now with the teachings. I didn't get the sense from him that was saying that you could only have one teacher. And I agree with you. I've been told, and you know, Lama Norla Rinpoche himself had several root lamas, and also, you know, any great teacher that, you know, that again resonates and brings you further on the path you take as, you know, as a teacher. So that's how I read that.
Okay, thank you.
You know, you have a question or a comment.
I have a quick question.
Go for it, Mark.
Which is, when they were talking about languages,
yeah,
I was thinking that whenever, you know, transmissions are given, they're always given in Tibetan.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how that, I don't know, it's just, maybe it's a silly question, but how that fits into the whole picture there.
There's no question. Like, the only silly question is the unasked question, right? We all have that question because, again, it's another language. But it was pointed out years ago that, for instance, Tibetan mantras, you know, Om Mani Padme Hum, or, well, you know, Tibet, they're just transliterated Hindi or Pali, whatever, that the Tibetans aren't saying it in the original language either. And so, as a matter of fact, there's the story of, and correct me, children, I don't remember the details, but of like the mother who was asking the son to come back with the tooth of the Buddha, and he, however it turned out, he just picked up and found it like a dog's tooth and brought it back to her. And but she, believing her faith in it, because again, it's all through her own minds, right, had such faith in it as being the Buddha that she, I don't know if she developed, you know, of course, in those days, you just automatically became an arhat or something, but regardless, you know, she, it was no different, so that it hasn't to do with, you know, especially during empowerments, if you have the mental attitude that you bring to it, is what enables transmission to take place. And transmissions can be completely without any words themselves. I know that Lama Norla Rinpoche years ago said that he would look at his teacher. And I spent a lot of time when he was meditating, and even now when like Lama Chodron gives us the instruction for doing the guru yoga where you imagine the Lama on top of your head and then entering into your heart. Like I spent a lot of time just watching Lama Norla Rinpoche when he was meditating with us, just looking at his stance, looking at the gaze of his eyes. And I often used that particular visualization above my head and inside my heart, and that I often do that now with teachers when meditating. I watch them to see their presence, their body, you know, their manifestation, and that is equal. So you can have a very much a nonverbal transmission as well. So I know that when it talks about the different languages, I think that's, you know, that's the sign of the level of the teachers. You know, we don't know, but who knows if, you know, I know that when, years ago, I heard that with this Karmapa, when he was back in Tibet and was like, I don't know if he was chanting Chenrezig or there was a Chenrezig empowerment, but apparently there were all these other, we couldn't perceive or whoever couldn't perceive, but apparently there were all of these beings from other dimensions that were actually there taking the empowerment from him, so that we don't know what teachers are able to do or not to do. But again, we're limited, and that's why it's saying that, that's why the precious human existence is so rare and precious, because not only are we in a time where the teachers are still present, but since teachers actually left Tibet because of historically what happened and they were forced to leave or to escape, whatever, the fact is they spread out into the world, and there are people that are smart enough and connected with the Dharma that can translate it to all the different languages. So that's an amazing opportunity for us now, that if we're, you know, if we're not able to meet the teachers who we can, that we can hear in whatever language they speak, we can understand it in our own language. We now at least are born in a time and with the conditions such that we have access to transmission through teachers, either through translation or they're learning our languages.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
Yeah. Anybody else have anything? If not, we'll end right on time.
And so next week, I'll be continuing again with the Ringa, with the relationship of the student, the teacher-disciple relationship.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lama Jinzong. Anybody else have anything before we do the prayers? Okay. Lama Jinzong, I don't know if you even have the prayer sheet with you. Do you want to lead the dedication, or would you rather I would do that?
Would you do that? Would you mind?
I'd be glad to do that. You probably need a little rest. That was masterful teaching, I thought. Really, really helpful.
Oh, good.
All right. So we'll... yes, you got a lot of thumbs up. I don't know if you saw them, but you just had a bunch of thumbs up. That's all. Okay, so now we can dedicate the merit of, sorry, I've muted you again. Let me unmute you.
If you could unmute. I just wanted to say, I finally found that it just, you know, we had the 8, then the 4, then the 2. Another way that, according to Minja Rinpoche, that says that there are 4 qualities that accompany an authentic teacher and their authentic lineage: history of study practice, compassionate and good-hearted, and being humble. Because I noticed that humility did not seem to come up in those listings of the 8, 4, and 2. So I just wanted to say that.
Yes, thank you.
That's it.
Thank you. All the sources, I mean, this is all the sources are good. It's good. The more, the merrier. All right. So let's do our dedication. We now have the good fortune to be able to dedicate all the benefit from this study, this teaching and this study, to the enlightenment of all beings, including ourselves. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the 2 sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And since we're a little early, we could take maybe 2 minutes and rest our minds in meditation, sort of back to the ultimate and relative bodhicitta, however you want to do it. Okay, and now coming back, I'll unmute everybody and we can all say goodbye. You're all unmuted.
Bye.
Bye.